Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a new series of Pubs, Pints, People, the Camera Podcast. I'm Claire Phillips. With me today are my fellow hosts Alison Tafts and Simon Webster. Hello, both of you.
Hello, Claire. Hello, Simon.
Long time no speak.
Indeed.
Hello, Alison. Hello, Claire. In a packed episode to kick off this new season, we're looking specifically at Mild and have something of a Midlands focus as I chat to Professor Carl Chin, who's long been connected to Birmingham University, was made an MBE for his services to local history, and has some fascinating facts about the history of Mild in that part of the world.
What a great subject to be starting a new series with. And I'll be hearing more about one of my absolute favourite beer styles, Mild 2, as I go on a mild odyssey in the Black Country, including meeting the sisters who are now running the Bathams Brewery, visiting good beer guide pubs searching for a taste of the black or ruby malty stuff, and going behind the scenes at the Sarah Hughes Brewery and the Beacon Hotel in Sedgley near Dudley.
It's funny you should mention them, because I was looking for Sarah Hughes Dark Ruby Mild to add to my shortlist when I was voting in the Champion Beer of Britain recently. And I got somewhat confused because I initially looked in the Milds category, couldn't find it there, and then found it in Brown Ales, Red Ales, Old Ales and Strong Mild, that natty little section. Well, luckily, I've been talking to the head judge of CBOB, as it's known, competition. We'll be hearing from her later on in the show. And I was able to ask about who decides how the different beers end up in which categories and more about the judging process. And of course, that's something that's been widely discussed since this year's winners were announced.
It certainly was. I remember when we were recording on the day at GBBF, there was a lot of discussion from everyone around the venue. So looking forward to hearing what Christine has to say a little bit later.
Mild, like all beer styles, has evolved and continues to evolve over time. It's hard to know precisely what mild has tasted like as the years have passed. But the term mild first appears as an indication of freshness. A mild-tasting running beer, served fresh from the brewery, and to differentiate it from the more intensely flavoured ales of that time that were matured in wooden barrels. In the late 1700s, brewers spoke of beer that was mild, fresh, or stale, aged. Here's a section from Martin Cornell's Amber, Gold and Black. Originally, the main, indeed the only standard for a beer called mild, was that it should be fresh, not more than a couple of weeks old, and have the taste and aroma that come with freshness. Any older, past the point at which the beer starts exhibiting the flavours that come with maturity, and it isn't mild anymore. At least, not what brewers would have recognised as mild back in the 19th and early 20th centuries. To quote one commentator from 1869, new ale and porter, which are free from acid, are named mild. That was it. For Victorian brewers, and those who came before them, any beer, strong or weak, hoppy or not, light or dark, could be called mild, if it was young enough. So, in history, a pint of mild could be any colour or style. But they were generally more lightly hopped, as they were drunk so quickly they didn't require the preservative quality of expensive hops. That's, I think, how the softer, malt-forward style began to evolve. And over time, mild became the pint of choice for the thirsty worker at the end of the shift, at the end of the day, and it dominated sales in the public bar. In the 1890s, it formed the bulk of production for many brewers, and mild was the biggest selling style right up to the late 1950s, when it was overtaken by bitter.
Now, I fell a bit in love with the mild style quite a few years ago, and I think it was my love of old ale that led me there originally. I've been enjoying the modern styles of mild from newer breweries, and this led me to, of course, the legendary Sarah Hughes Ruby Mild, and a deep curiosity to try some more milds. Names like Holden's and particularly Bathams. I'd never tried them, and I knew we needed to make the pilgrimage to the Black Country to try them and find out more. Now, luckily, our editor, David, is a man of the Midlands and lives in a village close to Wolverhampton. So I invited myself to stay, and David took me on a tour to discover mild in the wild. So first we visited Bathams. It's founded in the late 1880s and we were invited to their beautiful period ballroom above the brewery in Brierley Hill. There were slightly forbidding portraits of the ancestors and the founders all round the walls. The sixth generation of Bathams is in charge in 2023 and they are anything but forbidding. Claire is just in the process of taking over the running of the pub estate from Uncle Matt, and Alice, who has taken over from their father, running the production as head brewer. David and I started chatting to Claire and Alice and found them incredibly easy to speak with. The energy and enthusiasm was amazing. Our main challenge was getting the tape recorder running in time to capture the conversation. By the way, during this chat, Claire refers to kilns. Now, these are Killikin barrels. They're 18-gallon barrels holding 144 pints. And she also mentions hogsheads. They're 54 gallons. That's a whopping 432 pints. If you bear in mind the most common cask sizing use is the firkin, that's a 9-gallon 72 pints. This gives you an idea just how much of their cask beer their pubs are using. We start the interview first by asking how important brewing cask ale is to their business, and Claire comes in with the answer.
Oh, massively, yeah. I mean, the cask is sort of 85-90% of our sales. The pub next door still has hogsheads of bitter, so it's gallons and gallons of it, basically.
They're doing about 5 to 6 hogsheads a week. Yeah, apart from the tenants here, they're all wet lead pubs, so there's no sort of sit-down food or anything. They're proper community boozers, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I read that your sort of biggest selling beer is your bitter.
Yeah, by a massive percentage, actually. I've just been looking at some figure work for you to sort of show you. So between the like percentage sales between the bitter and the mild, we're like 97. In 2019, it was 97% bitter. But 2023 so far, it's 95% bitter. So that we've started to sell more mild in the last few years. It was only ever in firkins, wasn't it? And you've been able to sell it in kilns now because we're selling a lot more of it, which is good.
These styles we have to try and hang on to. We're starting to see sort of craft brewers, you know, they call them craft brewers, more sort of modern style brewers coming through and getting really falling in love with the style and starting to see more people playing with them. So it's great.
I really think the sort of ABV helps with that. So especially sort of the younger generations and the craft movement are really interested in. And this is what I'm hearing all over sort of Twitter and like the BBPA stuff. Mm-hmm. That no and low alcohol is just on the up. And I think the style just really helps.
But I think there are increasingly drinkers coming through on the younger side who are just willing to try everything and excited to try everything. So if you put a mild in front of them, they don't have any preconceptions, and so if it's gentle and malty and fruity and delicious and as a bonus is you know low in alcohol, that's a fantastic story. Yeah, so it's very exciting. Yeah. So thinking about that, you're brewing a lot of bitter, you're also now brewing more mild. What's the big difference, just from a sort of more technical point of view, about brewing bitter versus mild?
Yeah, so actually the way that we brew the mild is a part guile, so we take some wort off of a brew of bitter that we're gonna make. And then it's treated differently. We do different hops and a little bit of colour treatment. And then it's fermented in a separate tank. It's the same yeast. It's all everything's the same. And that's about it, really. Yeah, it's a similar fermentation. And then we rack it, like Claire said, we rack it straight into firkins and kilns. And it's also, we prime it a little bit in the cask just to get that extra condition in the pub cellar so that it gets the yeast going again.
So we're looking at that hop being crucial to the flavour then, from what you're saying. So the malt bill is actually the same.
Yeah, the malt bill is the same. It's actually the sort of additions that we make a little bit further downstream.
But it's interesting, the hops you're using then. So what is the difference between the bitter hopping regime and the hopping that you're doing with the mild?
So with the mild, it's just a little bit gentler. So the hops that we use, they're the same in both of them. They're just dosing rates are a little bit different. So they're both Fuggles and Goldings, which we get from Farrams, who are our long-standing supplier. Yes. Yeah.
So you've got those classic English hops, but using them in different quantities to give you a different character and make that much softer kind of flavour profile. Yeah. Okay. So when you think about, you know, you've got your brewing day laid out in front of you, for you, what makes this still an exciting thing that makes you want to sort of go forward into the next decades doing it?
I think just all of the history that's behind it, I really feel like so proud to be here and so proud to make the beer that our ancestors have made. I feel really lucky that I enjoy the process. So I've worked in other breweries and I've enjoyed that there. But there's just something about coming in, and I think the fact that we make bitter and mild, and that's the only two that we make all year round, there's something I find quite addictive about sort of trying to better it each time. So you really have to focus in on making it super consistent. And obviously it being a natural product, you know, our malt changes depending on the weather, or depending on the climate change that we're having at the moment. And it's a real sort of balancing act to get it absolutely consistent. And I really just enjoy that. I really enjoy like tweaking with it and working with the team to get the best out of the ingredients, basically.
So Claire, very much a family concern. Yes. How many people have you got working within the brewery here for the production and so on?
You've got five guys in your team, haven't you? And then there's obviously you and me, and we've got a couple of ladies in the offices. So what's that, about 11 of us? Yeah.
So there's 11 of you working here on the brewery site, and then obviously you've got your pubs out there. With
which then has, oh gosh, there's about 113 of us, something like 115, I think I'm doing payroll at the moment. Trying to think how many people I'm putting through. Yep, so 11 managers and then all of our bar staff. And sort of, so from my side of things, really, it's our customers and having those 3 years working at Plough and Harrow and just seeing how passionate they are about Bathams. We're passionate about it because it's our family, and they're passionate about it because it's, I mean, it's almost an extended family.
Yes.
They love it and we love it. And, you know, they'll come in and they'll say that they've been to this pub today and that pub today. And, you know, they'll give us feedback. And it's just the joy that they bring into the pub.
When you're not drinking delicious Bowman's bitter or mild, what do you choose to drink, Claire? What's your drink of choice outside of your own?
I'm really traditional, and I'll just always generally go for the golden ales.
You like trying on different casks.
Yeah,
really good at that. I think trying like different IPAs and stuff.
Yeah,
I think I stay away from those really. I much prefer sort of having like pilsners and lagers when I'm not drinking Bathams. When I was at Thornbridge, we used to go out with the brewing team. And it was always kind of a thing that all of the brewers would drink Lucas, which is their lager. Yeah. And I think maybe it's just from sweating all day in the brewery. You just need a little like more refreshing drink. Well, in the winter, I really like porters and that type of thing. Yeah.
So what do you think? What next for Bathams? What are you thinking about in terms of, you know, the coming future?
We do get asked this question quite a bit, actually, and for us personally, we're a lot more just trying to keep things as they are, you know, keep things running as successfully as they have been. And that's sort of the near future, that for Alice and I coming through as the next generation. That's where we're at the moment, is kind of being able to, like Alice has said previously, like keeping that constant and keeping the beer good and customers happy. So short term, that's the plan, really.
Yeah. Good. And do you see enough young folks coming in that you feel confident that you're going to keep that positive trajectory?
Well, Alice turned 30 on the weekend. As is Bathurst tradition, we did a beer bus. So I did it for mine and our older sister did it for hers. And so we went round 6 of the pubs on the weekend and, pint in each. And there was another 30th birthday beer bus going around doing the same thing. So I don't know, when you say young generation, is 30 young? we're seeing younger people come in. I think the fact that we've been able to keep the prices so fair as well. Obviously the mild's £2.60, the bitter is £3.50.
I'm just falling off a chair.
People appreciate that, and you know, it's a high quality product that we're being able to sell at a fair price, and it works. You know, it works. So yeah, I think the younger generation, like Alice was saying, I have great memories of when I was running the pub, and you would have like the older generations coming in, and they'd bring their sons and daughters in, and they'd buy me a pint, and I'd say, "You've got to try a pint of bitter as well." And no, I want a vodka and lemonade. And like, no, you have a bitter first, like half a bitter first, and then.
So,
There's definitely well, we kind of grew up in pubs, didn't we? You know, like we, as younger kids, and I think there is that generation as well, you know, and they understand, they understand pubs, and they understand how to be respectful in pubs, and we welcome children, you know, and we hope that they'll have such good memories the way that we did when we were younger, and, you know, and going forward, they'll come up and carry on drinking the Bathams.
And so for someone like me that's obviously been really curious to try your beers, but based in that they're London, where's the how far do you sort of get out? Where do the Bathams tentacles reach to? Where can I get hold of a pint of your bitter or mild?
Tend to go out towards, I don't know if you know, like Bridge North, Malvern Way.
Okay.
A few pubs,
which is further away from.
Yeah. I'm trying to think where we could.
No.
Sort of our main thing is keeping our cask local and keeping it fresh. When I did my dissertation at uni, I did a project on cask here, and I think the beer in our pubs, the beer only travels within like an 8-mile radius of the brewery, and I think maybe that's sort of, it's quite unique now. I think cask beer travels very far, and it's not the best idea for it, especially if you haven't got sort of a cold chain system in place. We have to maintain the reputation, and like we need to do that and keep an eye on the quality and make sure it's like absolutely top spec all the time. Yeah. Which is why you won't find it in London. And if you do, I'd be worried.
But the Black Country is great. Everyone should visit the Black Country because it's brilliant up here. So, you know, that's what we promote. And the local area is brilliant. We were obviously born and raised here. We love it.
Well, Claire and Alice sound amazing. It was really interesting to hear about their thoughts on the changing tastes of younger pub goers too. But when one of them said, is 30 young? I have to say, I'd say, yes, definitely, 30 is young. And the other thing that struck me was their thoughts on not travelling their beer very far. That's really interesting that they say to preserve the quality. I think we've probably all heard at some point, and perhaps maybe not recently, but in years gone by, oh, such and such beer doesn't travel, but not necessarily from the brewery themselves.
I was thinking something similar myself as well. It's interesting that so much of what they brew is drunk within such a short distance from the brewery. You know, they've clearly got some huge fans of the beers they brew in their local area.
And you've mentioned, Alison, that you were in the company of our editor-in-chief, David, while you were there. You also went to a number of pubs, I think, to sample the mild. So how did you both get on?
Well, we had a great time in the end, but it did prove a little harder than I thought to track down mild. But David and I stuck to our guns with our trusty Good Beer Guide app in our hands, and we eventually found some very delicious pints.
So we're here in the Vine Inn, otherwise known as what? What's its other name?
The Bull and Bladder.
The Bull and Bladder is what it's known as locally.
Yes.
I think it causes some confusion from what we gather, that people are confused.
When we came in, there was a bloke saying, what does Google call this place?
That's right. Is it called the Vine Inn is its technical name, and the one that's written above the door, and the very beautiful, elaborate frontage with lots of interesting things on there. And in front of David and I, we have the almost legendary Botham's Mild, don't we, David?
And a very fine glass full it is too.
So the colour is much lighter than one might expect from a mild. So, I mean, I would call that chestnut.
It's certainly not the kind of jet black to expect
no.
in a Black Country mild.
No, definitely not. And that is definitely, when we're holding it up against the light, I can see right through it for sure. And it is a, you know, honestly, it looks a little bit more perhaps like than you might expect. It's a slightly dark bitter to look.
Mm-hmm.
But it has the requisite creamy sparkled head and tart. Yeah. Lots of floof, as I always like to call it.
Sorry about that.
Creamy floof on top. It's an attractive looking drink, I must say. It looks very, very nice. And then on the nose, it's beautifully delicate on the nose. I'm getting a sort of lovely, it's a fruity yeast aroma, I think.
I mean, the word that just struck me when we had our first glass of mild. I just thought fresh. It just smelled fresh somehow.
Incredibly freshly brewed. Yeah,
in the way that, you know, when bread's just been baked, it's got that great smell of freshness. And it's just the same.
Yeah, I think on my tasting note, I described it as toasted tea cake. I don't know whether you can get that slight touch of sultana in there as well, but definitely a bready kind of yeast. It's very yeast driven, this beer, but on the nose, yeah, it's very inviting and very attractive. The thing that hits me first of all is this is beer that's all about mouthfeel. It's creamy, it's so smooth. There's nothing about this that's kind of bitter or jagged. There are no jagged edges. It's just pure smooth and creamy, and that lovely kind of doughy, again with the dark fruits. I don't know if it's sort of, is it plum, kind of a very gentle plum kind of
yeah dirty. But it's so gentle, isn't it? I mean, plum, hint of malt loaf, it's so delicate.
It really is. Yeah, no, it's lovely and soft, and you just want to go back for another. So I'm going in for another slurp.
Why not?
So yeah, incredibly drinkable. Very low bitterness, doesn't really have, it's got a tiny hint of bitterness on the finish, just at the back of the palate, but really is a soft, gentle, amazingly drinkable.
Mild by name, mild by nature.
But wow, that's so good. Very, very delicious.
Delicious.
So drinking Baytham's Mild in just next to the brewery, in the brewery tap.
And what a privilege to have met the brewer.
Yeah, superb, agreed. So we're here in the Great Western Pub, almost in the centre of Wolverhampton, close to the railway station. And you can tell we have a very strong railway theme in this particular pub. There's lots of beautiful heritage signs. There's even a heritage signal just sitting over David's head here.
I should point out that's not a sound effect, that's actually a train going over the bridge nearby.
Yeah. So in front of us, we've got two cheeky halves of the Holden's Mild.
It has to be done.
It does. Colour-wise, it is a very sunny day and the sun's shining through the window, but it's a very light mild, isn't it?
Yeah.
Describe that as chestnut.
Yes, I think that's a good description. Interesting, I mean, the Banks' Mild, as we'll see later on, is much paler than this. The Highgate Mild, which I lament the passing of, was a proper black...
Proper dark mild. So the Highgate Mild was brewed by Mitchells and Butlers back in the day when they brewed in Walsall. It has got that classic sort of fruity, dried fruit.
Dare I say, a slight hint of dandelion and burdock.
oh, that's a great tasting
But
note.
It's got that. It has
a whiff of dandelion and burdock. I love the texture. It's very smooth. And it's got that very gentle, malty, almost no bitterness really to speak of. Maybe just a tiny hint of a lift of bitterness right at the very end. It's got a decent length, actually, for the ABV. What was it, 3.7, I think? Yeah, 3.7.
Quite low.
Yeah.
I was once told by a landlord in a Desi pub that this is probably the best kind of beer to have with a curry.
With a curry, I'm absolutely right, yeah, because it's got that lovely, smooth, kind of gentle quenching. Your fire, if you've got some chilies going on, yeah, definitely. So yeah, I'm enjoying that. It's
good,
nice.
Good.
And it's in a terrific
it's pure black country glass.
Holden's pure black country, and there's their little chap on their label who's wearing a bowler.
No, I'm pleased to see as a Londoner that you didn't fall over when the price popped up at less than £4 for two halves.
I just smiled in a rare smile when paying the bill for a beer in a pub. No, it's fantastically good value, of course. It's, but yeah, really enjoyable. Cheers, David.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Good health.
So we've come to the source again, and we are at the Old Swan pub, which is the base of the Old Swan Brewery, and we have in front of us the Old Swan Black Widow, otherwise known as Mar Pardo's. Do you know why it's called Mar Pardo's, David?
I don't. I don't know if that goes back to one of the sort of early landladies.
Sounds likely, doesn't it? But it is. It's that sort of dark chestnut colour again, and we've got a very thin head actually today for this one. Perhaps not as sparkly as previous heads we've had, but maybe a slightly less tight sparkle this one's been through. But it does have that characteristic dark fruit and malt aroma.
And we should say this is a brew pub.
Yeah, they're brewing their own beer here, so we are at the source. So it's definitely got a lot more of the dark, sort of licorice-like characters. Almost roasty, perhaps, character on the palate. it's definitely on the mild spectrum though in terms of what it's offering up. But I would say that would remind me more of an old ale than a mild. It's got the alcohol. It's over 6%. So yeah, definitely on the sort of much more on the old ale spectrum. But yeah, very. It lingers. It does linger on the palate, definitely, with that sort of slightly roasty, slightly licoricey, and perhaps less of the dark fruit, less of the sort of malt loaf character, but a bit more of that kind of. It's starting to go towards a bit more towards a stout. So yeah.
But for anybody who finds stout too hefty, then this is a.
Yeah, it's the sort of light version of a stout. Yeah. Stout. It does have a nice creamy mouthfeel for sure. So yeah, that's the Black Widow. From the Old Swan, otherwise known as Old Marpado. Inevitably, yes. So we are in the Swan. Where are we in the world, David?
We're in Compton, which is on the outskirts of Wolverhampton, if you're heading out from the city towards Bridge North.
And we've come in search of...
Banks's Mild.
Banks's Mild. So we have one in front of us, colour-wise. Mm.
It's a mix of bitter and mild. It's not necessarily full true mild, but... Very popular, very tasty.
But it looks, if you ask me what that was, I would say that's a pint of bitter with a slightly tan coloured head. Not too big a head, it's sort of medium reasonable, I would say. And on the nose, oh, it's got that distinctive fruity, that plummy, fruity character that I would expect with a mild. It's very light, really light, light on its feet, gentle. And again, really soft on the palate. Almost no bitterness whatsoever. It's just very, very low bitterness, but just that sort of slight hit of dark fruit on the front of the palate, and then it sort of dies away very quickly. So it's a very short finish on that, I think.
I'm certainly getting the malt in there as well. But yeah, it's so light and easy drinking.
Very much so, yeah. And it's as I say, it's gone in a heartbeat, that one. So I can see why you'd want to drink a pint of that very quickly if you were very thirsty.
Yeah, I think it's a good beer. I mean, I know, Banks's is big. It's took over Marston's, now taking over Margaret the Brewing Stand with Carlsberg. But there's nothing wrong with that.
No. Well, it's not particularly busy in here this afternoon, but as we look around, we can see people around us, and nobody's drinking this, are they?
Nope. Sunbeam came out a few years ago, probably longer now than I remember, which is their kind of light citra-based beer. Very successful, very tasty beer. Maybe it's the weather, I don't know. There's a dark one over there, but that's not this.
No, that's definitely not. It's porter or stout of some sort. As you say, extremely drinkable, light, mild.
I don't understand always this sort of dark beer in the winter thing, because to me that's a perfect summer beer.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, but it's very common that people wouldn't want to drink a darker beer in the winter. But, that is light on its feet. Banks's Mild. So we've got in front of us here, in our glasses, the... unmistakable ruby red colour of this wonderful Sarah Hughes Ruby Mild.
And it is, there is a red to it.
Goodness, yeah.
Especially when you look from the side of the glass, it's so predominantly dark, I'd never really noticed.
But if you look at the bottom of my glass there, can you see how red that is?
And I mean, mine. It
really is quite ruby.
It's like a little layer of Ribena at the bottom of the glass.
I don't think it's going to resemble Ribena in any other way. Oh, it's really aromatic, this beer. I mean, that is dark fruits and... I think I've said this before, but it's like a malt loaf. It's like a slice of malt loaf with a big slab of butter on top. Mm. That's beautiful, that aroma. Glorious. There's so much going on. Plums, dried plums, and maybe a tiny bit hint of prunes, and then that big old slab of malt loaf.
Great taste, isn't it?
Great taste. It's beautiful. It's big, rich, full, silky on the palate. The texture's terrific. As you swallow, you get that lovely waft of that big, plummy, sort of dried fruit, kind of back to my malt loaf again.
And also we've got the mouthfeel, which is kind of well on the way to sort of Christmas beers and old ales, isn't it? There's so much flavour in there. I'm almost feeling like it's a Christmassy treat. There's so much going on. It's great.
It's that plum pudding you kind of
it's wonderful.
Character. Yeah, there might even be a hint of spice there as well. This is a very clever beer. Oh. that we've gone quiet now because we're just slurping it.
Sadly, we've got to prioritise and the beer comes before the podcast.
I assume when you were going around all those different pubs, you only recorded the ones that actually had mild. So we won't ask how many other pubs you may or may not have gone into. And was it only mild you were tasting?
No, there were a few more, but we obviously had to try the Baytham's Bitter as well, and it was absolutely delicious. Very soft and gentle, distinctly Moorish, and sparkled, of course, what I like to call a floofy pint.
Ah, the contentious sparkler in the Midlands as well.
Well, that could be a topic for a future podcast, perhaps.
Oh, definitely. Let's plan it. I bet we can get a multitude of opinions on that one.
Now, moving on from Alison and David's adventures around the West Midlands, we're going to chat now with Professor Carl Chin. Carl is well known across the region for his deep love of mild and everything else to do with the area. And in my chat with Carl, he explains why he had no choice but to drink mild from when he first walked into a pub in the Midlands, and how, as over time, things have changed, and why Carl believes that the big breweries have a lot to answer for when it comes to the decline of mild. Today, I'm joined by Carl Chin. Carl is an English historian, writer and broadcaster whose working life has been devoted to the study and popularisation of the city of Birmingham. Carl, welcome.
Thank you, Simon.
Now, the focus of this episode of Pubs, Pints, People is on mild ale. As someone who's been drinking mild since the age of 16, what are the first words which come to mind when you think of mild?
Busting beer. I had no choice about drinking mild, just like I had no choice being a Villa fan and no choice being a Brummie. You're born that way. I started drinking properly with my great uncles, my mum's uncles, my great uncle George and great uncle Bill. They were from Aston, and the Ansell's Brewery was very close to where they grew up. I'd have a drink with them at the King Standing Ex-Servicemen's Club, Pipe's, the Forget-Me-Not Club, and sometimes at the Aston Social Club. And older working men in those days, and middle-aged men and younger men, it was overwhelmingly mild. There was two major breweries, dominating brewery, Birmingham, in the 70s when I started drinking, Ansell's and M&B. M&B was probably better known for its bitter rather than its mild, yep. But Ansell's mild was seen as a really good mild. It was a nutty taste. I still got the taste in my mouth, even though it's been gone many years. So I had no choice going in to the clubs. What do you want to drink? I don't know, Unc, pint of mild. And that was it, and I love the taste.
But why do you think mild is so synonymous with the Midlands in particular?
I think it's because it survived longer here in the Midlands than elsewhere. Years ago, I'm going back now to in my early 20s, we went down to Erith in Kent, and we went into a pub and asked for a pint of mild, and the gaffer was absolutely delighted. And I know that mild is still popular in parts of Yorkshire and Lancashire, as well as Birmingham and the Black Country. But there's a massive problem, Simon, in that breweries, big breweries, turned against mild. And it seems to me to have fitted into that change that was happening to pubs in the late 20th century, when they took out the bar, they took out the dominoes, they took out the darts, and they took out the mild. And then they'd say, well, you go to them, well, why is there no mild in? There's no call for mild. Well, there was no call for mild because you didn't serve the mild. And then there was this big focus on lager drinking, that it was cool, etc. So I think the big breweries have a lot to answer for in the decline of mild drinking.
So you talked about some of the milds that you drank as a youngster. What are your favourite milds today, and has the taste changed at all over time?
I think there's different tastes with mild. It's not a homogenous drink. I like Holden's mild from the Black Country. That's a really old-fashioned mild. I'm also really keen on Rudgate Brewery's mild. I'm sure you've heard of it,
yes,
Simon,
yes.
Up in Yorkshire. And I get some of the Rudgate's mild delivered to me home. It's a 4.4%, so it's strong for a mild. It's a ruby mild. It's a beautiful drink, but so is Holden's. It's a more of a traditional West Midlands dark black mild almost. And I really enjoy that. A very strong mild in the Black Country, I think it's over 6%, is at the Beacon in Sedgley. Very strong mild. Another good one that's been a brewery that's really started to come back to the fore is Davenport's mild in Birmingham. There's a superb real ale pub in Birmingham as well called the Wellington, and they serve a number of milds, because unfortunately, Simon, it's very difficult now to get mild in any pub. a few working men's clubs, or the equivalent of working men's clubs, still serve mild on draft. But it's really becoming more and more difficult to get mild on draft. So that's why I'd like to give a big thank you to the Wellington in Birmingham for carrying on the tradition of serving draft mild.
The Wellington will be a pub that's known to many listeners of this and camera members, because I know it hosts regular camera meetings up on the meeting floor on the top floor.
It does, and Nigel has done such a wonderful job. He first came to Birmingham when he took over at the Barton's Arms, that magnificent late Victorian stroke Edwardian drinking emporium in Aston. It's a stunning pub. I don't know if you've been there. Nigel came there, and then he moved on to, you know, he was really keen on real ales, and he has done a sterling job, because for many years Birmingham was a desert with regard to good real ales, and he transformed that.
And just thinking beyond mild as we wrap up, you know, what are your favourite pubs across the Midlands, or any breweries in particular that you would particularly recommend?
The Black Country has managed to survive as a stronghold of small breweries and small pubs. There's Marpardo's in Netherton, there's the Beacon, yep, that we've already mentioned. In Birmingham, obviously, there's the Wellington. I would love to see the White Swan reopened in Bradford Street. It's closed now. I hear there's plans to reopen the Woodman by Curzon Street railway station. I'm much more comfortable in older back street pubs, although in the city centre we have some tremendous pubs like the Old Contemptibles, the Old Royal, the Joint Stock and others.
And slightly further afield, Wolverhampton's got, is it the Great Western, which is close to the station, which is another renowned pub.
Yeah, I haven't been to the Great Western for years, but that's a stunning pub, hidden away, but really popular.
Carl, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us on Pubs, Pints, People today.
Take care, Simon. Thanks for inviting me.
And that enthusiasm, Carl, really sums up the warmth of beer lovers from that part of the world, doesn't he, Simon?
Absolutely. As you said, the accent, but just the enthusiasm, you know, his deep love of that region and of the mild style of beer in particular. You know, I can't imagine Carl's drunk much else in his life. He just seems to be a dedicated disciple of mild.
Quite right, too. Speaking of fabulous mild, I finally got to see inside the Sarah Hughes Brewery, where I began by meeting Ricky Follos, the brewer. He originally saw a job advert and then had a rather unusual interview from the Post.
I saw the advert for the job and he said, can you come and interview? He said, can you lift that? And how old am you? And then he found me back like the next week and said, you can have the job if you want it.
Fantastic.
And I've been here 7 years now.
It was meant to be.
It's a great place. It's like working in history. It's a local history as well.
What's the biggest seller? Is it the Ruby Mild?
No. It's a Sedgley Surprise in the pub.
Surprise.
So that still goes into 36s. When we rack the amber, it goes into 18s. And when we rack the ruby, it goes into 18s.
So here's your lovely grain hopper and your malt's coming in here.
Yeah.
And you've got your lovely Maris Otter and you've got your little bit of caramel, did you say?
Crystal.
Crystal malt, crystal, that's malt, it. Yeah. That's what you said. So you get that lovely caramelisation on that,
We load up the night before a brew.
Yep.
And then the girl comes up about 10 o'clock at night, lights a boiler for me to light the liquor tank if it's over there.
Oh, wow, yeah. So it's a proper... So how does she do
it's
that?
It's gas-powered now.
Okay, fantastic.
Back in the day, it would have been coal-powered.
Of course.
But obviously, it's gas-powered now. When I come in the morning, it's usually about 90 degrees. So I'll bring it down to 72, and we're mashing at 72.
Perfect.
So I've got my little stool, and we've got the old-fashioned mash paddle.
Oh, my gosh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. So this is still a hatch. They just open the hatch slightly.
Yep.
Stuck now because I'm cleaning it. And then it falls in there, and I just stir it like a big bowl of porridge for them. Takes about 20 minutes.
So it's a classic using gravity to help you.
We've got two electric pumps, and I think that's just because you have to.
Yeah.
No, we'd be here all day dropping that beer if not. We've got the two wooden lids, which I'll show you. You put your two wooden lids on, which we just keep in here out of the way. So it's proper still, I'll put them on there. And then it's left for an hour and a half, just to get all the sugars out.
Yeah, so you're drawing all that sugar.
Come back up after an hour and a half. Because there's only me, during that hour and a half, I fill the cellar up, get the yeast ready. If Kirsty's not done the hops for me the day before, I'll do the hops. We still use leaf hops. Goldings, Brambling Cross and Fuggles. We only use British. So I'll come back up, then it's time to sparge, as you know.
Yep.
So I'll put the ring in, and then we sparge, try and sparge at 72 as well. So this ring sits in here like it is now. The water comes in through the hot liquor tank.
Sprays down in there.
Yeah, so it doesn't spin or nothing, just old-fashioned holes in the ring. Then you've got your underback, and then it goes into the copper.
That's absolutely fabulous, that copper.
It's 1935. Glorious. Oh. And it's not moved since.
I bet it hasn't.
Still the same.
It's got that lovely tiled surround, and you can see right deep into that lovely burnished copper.
Looks beautiful.
So that takes about 2 hours to fill up. And then as it starts to boil, take your first reading, put your first ops in. Second reading, just to make sure it's dropping. It drops 1 point every 20 minutes, our stuff does. So then it drops again, and then on your third reading, 5 minutes after that, last hops, Irish Moss, and then you're off the boil 5 minutes before the hour's up, and then that's basically it here. So then you just let it settle in there, and then we drop it down to the next floor.
So everything was in situ, left behind, from it just laying there for 30 years with no brewing.
Cobwebs everywhere, I think.
Yeah.
So they had to have a new liquor tank put in. That's all I'm aware that he had to have done, to be honest.
But everything else is the original.
So this is the fermenting room.
Wow. Fabulous.
So each brew fills two of the tanks. I've got a surprise in there at the minute, if you want to have a look.
Oh, yes. It smells lovely.
If we've got the fresh yeast, it usually ferments in about 3 days. But last week I did amber, ruby, sage. I transferred the amber yesterday and it's racked today. So a bit of a week, 7 days. It's racked in there. I just put the hose on there, connect it to the two tanks, and then put it in the big racking tank there. So I've got a ruby in there at the minute. And then when we rack, it's just the old fashioned hose on the tap, line my four nines down or whatever, and just fill one by one.
Yep. Lovely. And a bit of priming liquid.
We put isinglass when I transferred it.
Yeah.
And then that's the process done, it goes off down the cellar.
Off it goes to the condition.
Yeah.
Well, your beer is well known all over the country. Yeah. People come here especially to get some.
Yeah. I mean, we did Black Country Day tours. We have Black Country Day around here. Celebrate the heritage, the industrial and everything. And I think I did, in 2 hours, I did a tour every 10 minutes. And more people wanted to come, but we just couldn't fit them in. So that was good. People walk past, but they don't know what goes into it. And
of course.
So we had a lot of regulars coming. It was a nice day, that was. It's just nice to be part of history.
Of course. Yeah, fantastic.
You got to remember where you've come from here.
Well, those tours that he talked about sound absolutely great. And I think you also then had to look around the Beacon Hotel itself, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I had been to the Beacon with Phil a while ago, but I had a chance to spend a bit of time there soaking up that fantastic atmosphere. And I also had a chat with Alex, who runs the pub, and started by asking her what she loves most about running the Beacon Hotel.
The people, I suppose, number one. Because when the pub's empty, it's got a completely different atmosphere. And then as soon as you open the pub and the people come in, it sort of changes and it becomes something else.
Yeah.
And without the people, obviously, we wouldn't be anything. But we were shut during COVID. It was the company that we missed more than the work itself.
Did you do any takeaway or anything during COVID?
We did at first, but then they changed the rules, didn't they, briefly?
Yeah,
and then
the
that sort of scared us, and then we stopped doing it, and then they allowed you to do it again, but we just didn't pick it back up again. But we renovated the pub. It needed a lot of work doing, so we spent the time doing that.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it does. The bar needed to be completely sort of revamped. So we did that, and then the rafters just below the bar, they'd started to rot because like the beer had been soaking in. So we had to have those replaced. So a lot of the structural work, like below the bar in the cellar, that was replaced.
So that was great to get that done.
Yeah, and we didn't realise just how desperately it needed to be done, and it was really the only opportunity we could have had unless we closed. So
you made the best of it.
We did.
So the room we're sitting in now is this
smoke room?
Yes, smoke room. So this is presumably where people used to come and have a.
I guess so. Yeah, I'm not really sure why it was called that, but we've got smoke room, tap room, and snook. I suppose the tap room was named because it used to have taps in there, so it was somewhere that you could get beer that wasn't the bar. I'm not sure about the smoke room. I guess it must be to do with smoking, but then when before the smoking ban, everyone could smoke wherever they wanted, really.
So this is kind of oak panelled, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've got these lovely button-backed sort of gorgeous red, deep red sort of oxblood colour, would you call it?
Oxblood colour.
Yeah, these lovely sort of Chesterfield banquettes, I think you can call them. And how do people choose where they're going to sit? Why do they come and sit in here?
There's different characters for a different room. So the tap room, there's a door that they can shut. So that seems to be like the room where you go if you want to be a bit sweary. Not that they get up to anything naughty, but it's sort of like they can shut off from everybody else. The smoke room is probably the posher room. And then the snug simile is quite posh in there. The kids' room, we call it, the veranda. It's where they're under 18s. So it gets filled up with children and families, but also people who want to go outside and use the smoking area.
Obviously, you've got loads of regulars.
Like, I've known them for 20 years, and they've been coming here for 30 or 40. They're, you know, literally part of the furniture.
Absolutely. And they notice they're all drinking the Sedgley Surprise.
Mostly Surprise. This time of year, we sell less Ruby because it's warm and people want something a bit more refreshing. But then we get a lot of groups coming in over the weekend, from different areas, like camera groups, or they might just be doing coach parties, and they'll come in and they'll specifically drink the Ruby, so it does still sell really well. But this time of year, I think the conditions are a lot better because we sell a little bit less of it. We're able to hold on to it a little bit longer, and I'd always prefer it this time of year.
And what's it like working behind that very interesting little bar with the low windows,
no space?
Do you get a crick in the neck from bending down all the time?
Yeah, I've had a bad back all my life. About 20 years of it. It gets a bit tight on weekends when there's three or four of us trying to squeeze in and serve.
All dancing around each other.
Because it feels quiet now, but this pub gets really, really busy. So we can get queues and queues of people. And when there's, well, at the most, really, you can fit three people in there.
And apart from your beers, what else do you sell quite a lot of?
We tend to keep the guest beers quite hoppy to sort of balance our sweetness. But mostly it's our stuff. It's about 90% our stuff.
What's the price of the pint of your Sedgley Surprise?
£3.50. Wow. Dirt cheek.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, obviously I come from London, so that sounds like an extraordinary bargain to me.
Yeah. Well, even for the area, we're on the reasonable end of it. Some of our guest beers are probably a little bit more expensive, but we have to pay more for them, so they would be. But our house beers are very reasonable. The Ruby is only £3.70.
Unbelievable, Alex. Yeah. And what's your favourite when you, if you're going to have a beer after an odd occasion when you might want to have one after a shift?
It's got to be the Ruby.
Wow, I was really, really struck by the price of the beers that you spoke about in that interview. So £3.50 or £3.70 for a pint just feels incredible in this day and age. And also, the Bathams earlier said that, you know, mild was served for £2.60 a pint.
I know, it's shocking, isn't it? Wow. I don't know, we know what to say.
£2.60, I mean, that really is unbelievably inexpensive. But £3.50 and £3.70, you know, I'm in Suffolk, and actually, our local pub still sells most pints for £3.40 a pint. So for me, it's not surprising, but I guess it's these big city prices, these your London prices that, of course, us out in the sticks, you know, tend to steer clear of.
Well, I'm going to say nothing at this point to that. Running a pub in London.
But Simon, I mean, what would you normally pay for a pint of beer?
Well, yeah, drinking in central London, you're looking at £5 or £6 for a pint of cask beer. It's really hard to get one for less than £5 unless you're going into some of the larger chains.
The difficulty is the economies of scale. It's a different story where we're talking about rents and rates and things like that. So it really does provide a very, very different economic backdrop. So it's extremely difficult to compare prices, I think, across the geography.
And I guess as well, it depends what you're drinking. I mean, there's another pub that I know of right out in the sticks, but it sells some very unusual, we've talked in the past on the show about sours and that sort of thing. And obviously their beers are much more expensive than £3.50 a pint. But you're talking about, as you say, economies of scale and a different style of beer altogether. I think we're probably just quite lucky with our local pub. I guess the country's biggest pub in August is probably the Great British Beer Festival. And when I was at the GBBF this summer, I caught up with Dean Barrett. Now, Dean's recently been elected to Camra's National Executive. I'm sure that many people will know that Camra has a national executive, but if you then dig a bit deeper and say what's its role, what you have to do to get onto it, maybe we'd all be a bit more hazy about what exactly it is and what it does. So I started by asking Dean what his reasons were for standing.
I wanted to do this, and I'm really interested in the strength of Camera as a brand. I mean, I have been appointed commercial director, so I hope I'm in the right place to do something about that. I think we are a strong brand amongst members, but we need to be a stronger brand with the public when there are so many other things that compete for their time, their money and their leisure time, actually.
When did you first join Camera, Dean?
I joined Camera at my local festival, which was the North Hertfordshire Festival. It was in Letchworth Garden City, which is my hometown. Somewhere in the 1980s, I moved there in 1986, and it was fairly soon because it was 5 minutes from my home. And then I worked abroad for a number of years, but had a desire to get more involved. I kept seeing the branch newsletter come through, and I think I really need to do something about that. Oh, I can't make that date. So when I got early retirement from my career, it was on my bucket list of things to do.
And what drew you to Camera in the first place? Was it just that you loved beer, as simple as that?
Well, I was converted to Real Ale at university, actually. I had never heard of it. And even then, it wasn't called Real Ale. So that would have been in 1977. I'd been drinking, essentially, lager and lime until then. And so I discovered Castle Eden Ale was my first favourite ale. In Loughborough University, Perch had a fantastic students' bar. And only when I got to Letchworth and saw the Camera Beer Festival did I think, well, that's what this is all about. And that's when I got interested. So I've been a real ale drinker for a long time, as a real enthusiast, I suppose, since the late 1980s.
What made you decide to stand for the National Executive? Because you've come up very much through the grassroots of the branch.
Well, grassroots of Camera, but I've been a functional director of my company for many years, since, when was it, 1981. And I've always been in commercial functions, sales, marketing, and branding. And my last career job was actually branding the Opel network. That's a car dealership network in Germany, sister of Vauxhall. So I really got much strength of feeling about how important a brand was to an organisation. Now, I didn't know I would be immediately given the responsibility for that. I'm very glad that I have, but I still thought that my organisational skills, and it's what I pitched on, would be a benefit to bring the grassroots and the centre, and by the centre I mean the central staff and the national executive together, close the gap, so to speak.
I think a lot of people, if they've even heard of the national executive of Camera, and of course there will be members who might have heard about it but are not really sure what it is or that it could in any way be relevant to them, but a lot of people might think, well, surely you have to be running the Great British Beer Festival for at least 10 years before you can even think about standing or have something to do with head office. It's not like that at all, though, is it?
No, because you need breadth. I mean, Catherine Tonry, who runs the Great British Beer Festival, that's her thing. She does a fantastic job. But we have a number of committees, just like organisations have a number of departments, we have divisions and we have committees of volunteers, and it's the bringing of those together that's important. So you don't need all beer enthusiasts or beer festival organisers. You need people with commercial skills, people skills, marketing skills, and I thought there was an angle that I could, a gap that I could fill, shall I put it that way.
And you also take on a regional role as well, don't you? You sort of look after the area that you're a part of.
Yeah, so each county has, in theory, a county organiser, an area organiser, they call it at the moment. I mean, and they, so for instance, Hertfordshire has four branches, and they are essentially a division of the territory to make sure that you can cover the ground of the pubs and the judging of the beer and which pubs go in the good beer guide. So it's the coordination of those branches together and then move that up to region, which is important. So it goes branch, county, region. And those regional directors are also a very important part of our leadership as well.
And for people who are in their grassroots branch, perhaps they go along to their local beer festival, maybe they help out, perhaps they make a few recommendations for the local pub of the year or whatever they do, they may think, well, I don't even bother to vote in the National Executive. Why should they?
I think that the people who are active in the branches do vote. I think most of the people who are branch members don't know anything about it. That was my experience just by chance going to a beer festival, St. Neots as it happens, and saying to people with a little flyer in my hand, you do realise that the four of us, six of us it was, candidates for National Executive, are all members like you, and you can vote for us. Four of us will be elected. No. But they were really interested that that's the way the Camera is indeed run. Because we put up at our festivals, local festivals particularly, Camera is a volunteer-led organisation. They don't realise it's literally led by volunteers. They think, oh yeah, I can see there are volunteers running this festival. They do not understand that it's actually the company directors who take responsibility for the health and wealth of the company. And it is a company. You know, we are a not-for-profit company, but we are a company. And therefore, we've got directorial responsibility. You know, Camera was formed in 1971 by relatively young people. Those relatively young people have all got old, and we don't have the depth of younger people coming in. It's not just about age, but we do have to realise that society is to change the way people are, and it's not COVID. That's been a big change. But it is that people have a lot of calls on their time and probably don't see that it's something they can do justice to, if I can put it that way.
You've got this commercial role. Does that mean you'll be bringing more sponsorship into Camera, working with different partners?
Well, it may do. I mean, that isn't my initial focus. I don't like to come in like a new broom and just sweep clean, because there's a lot of great things about the Camera brand. But I do feel that we've got to reconnect with the history and the future, because we came through two very big things which were opposite effects. We came through COVID, where there were no beer festivals and you had to do everything virtually. Then we had our 50th anniversary, which was great, and now it's kind of now what, you know. And that's what I feel, that there's a bit of a sigh of relief, which should be a sigh of inspiration, if I could call it that. And that's what I'd like to kind of gee us up to do, be inspired about the brand.
Camera's, well, part of Camera's brand is it's about pubs, pints and people. Which one of those is the most critical for you?
The people, funny enough, because it embraces them all. And I like the fact that you can explain those three words many ways. I mean, our mission is now quite long. You know, we espouse not only real ale, but real cider, real perry. We want to look after pubs, we want to look after breweries, and we will look after drinkers. Try putting that in a phrase. I'd actually choose pubs, pints, people.
So Dean mentioned there that he got first involved with Camera at his local beer festival at Letchworth. Am I right in thinking that Letchworth was originally built without pubs?
That's right. Letchworth Garden City was the idea of a social reformer called Ebenezer Howard, and he was teetotal. So there was a very early pub there when it was built, and it was called the Skittles Inn, but it wasn't allowed to serve alcohol. It served apple juice, tea, hot chocolate, that sort of thing. Now, Dean told me that when he was moving to the area, it never occurred to him to check whether the town had any pubs, which it didn't. But things have changed since then, and there are a number of pubs there now. But, I mean, who buys a house without looking at where the nearest pub is? And is it walking distance?
Well, I certainly wouldn't. My goodness, that's so important.
For any of our listeners, if Dean's voice sounded familiar, it's because he was an early contributor to Pubs, Pints, People during lockdown, and someone who I'm sure we'll be hearing from again before too long. It was a really good point that he made about the amount of volunteer effort that goes into everything that Camera does. We are very much a volunteer-led organisation. Perhaps the most visible examples of that is those who organise and work at our beer festivals up and down the country, but you also have people who serve on different roles on branch committees, to people who take on the more responsibility, such as regional directors or even being a member of the National Executive. Of course, this podcast, everything that we do from the script writing through the recording and the production and the social media, is driven entirely by volunteers. And it's really thanks to all of those behind the scenes who makes something like this happen.
Now, we were hearing earlier about Alison's trip to the Midlands, and it sounds like you had a fantastic time visiting all those pubs. But talking of visiting pubs, in every episode of Pubs, Pints, People, we like to bring you a feature that we've been calling We're Only Here for the Beer, where we look through our editions or our apps of Camera's Good Beer Guide and pick out a favourite gem or perhaps somewhere we'd like to visit. Well, when the 51st edition of the Good Beer Guide came out at the beginning of October, as ever, there were those who were disappointed that their particular favourite hadn't got in.
Now, social media can be a harsh judge, and one branch that came in for a bashing was Tyneside in Northumberland. Branch chair Paul Hillhouse put a comprehensive and considered statement on their Facebook page about how the competition is judged. It really is worth having a read.
Yeah, controversy seems to have been following Camera around a bit this year, and we're here later in this episode when Claire chats to Christine Crine, the head judge for the Champion Beer of Britain competition. But pubs are still having a tough time of it, and government statistics suggested recently that two pubs are closing a day in England and Wales. 230 vanished in the 3 months to June. Perhaps we should rename this feature Still Here for the Beer.
So I'm still here for the beer this month, and I was absolutely delighted to visit the Nag's Head in Reading on Friday. Never been before. The Nag's Head is a multi-camera award-winning pub, about 15 minutes walk from Reading Station, just as you're getting into a more residential area. But I walked in on a Friday night and the pub was absolutely rammed. Just a really nice atmosphere. And then on the bar you had, there was about 10 taps. Pouring cask ale, so you had around 7 or 8 beers from Brew York. They were a bit of a tap takeover. There was one real cider on hand pull, but I'd really attended for Elusive Brewing's Collabageddon, where Elusive had got together with 11 other breweries. They'd all partnered together and they'd brewed 12 different beers. So I was sitting there across the evening drinking my thirds and my halves and working my way through most of the beers that were available. So a really enjoyable evening in a absolutely cracking pub not far from Reading Town Centre.
That sounds fantastic. I think I'll have to add that to the list of pubs that I want to visit. Well, Simon, earlier you mentioned about the Tyneside and Northumberland branch and their comments on how they choose their pubs for the Good Beer Guide. I'm actually picking one of their GBG selections, in fact, as I was on holiday in that region earlier this year. And I picked up a copy of their branch magazine, Canny Bevy, which we've mentioned on the podcast before. It's certainly worth a read. And the pub, and in fact the brewery that's on my wish list of places to visit, is the Twice Brewed Inn. It's near Hadrian's Wall in a village called Once Brewed. It's also actually very close to the area known as Sycamore Gap, and that was where the famous tree was felled recently. So while in Northumberland, although I didn't get to visit that pub, I did buy a bottle of Twice Brewed's Sycamore Gap Pale Ale. It's got a picture of the tree on the label. I'm not sure what they're going to do going forward. Hopefully it won't just be a picture of a stump or something. But that's only as close as I've got so far. So I'll have to get back up to that part of the world at some point and visit the pub. And particularly they hold stargazing nights, which sound absolutely brilliant. So that's definitely on my wish list.
Oh, my goodness. A great pint and a sky full of stars. I can't imagine anything nicer, Claire. What a great choice. I'm going to stick with my Midlands pubs. No surprise for this particular episode. And a big shout to the Great Western pub, an ex-champion beer, champion pub, rather. That's in Sun Street in Wolverhampton, very close to the station. As you heard, David and I enjoying a pint of Holden's in there. But overall, I want to give a big shout to The Vine, aka the Bullet and Bladder in Brierley Hill. Now, that's the brewery tap for the Bathams Brewery. It's called the Bull and Bladder locally because it's built on what used to be a slaughterhouse, and it's still adorned with wonderful heads of cattle and various sort of nods to its past all around the pub. It's a beautiful pub inside. We mentioned beer, it's tip-top quality, as you would imagine. And David and I also enjoyed a beautiful plate of faggots and chips with gravy, which was sensational and remarkable value. So definitely highly recommended, The Vine in Brierley Hill.
Great choice there. Now, we mentioned earlier that we'd be talking about the champion beer of Britain, CBOB, as it's known in Camera circles. And the first round of judging, or voting anyway, is from Camera members themselves. Now, there are vast numbers of beers on the website. Members can vote for up to 5 in each category. There's 14 categories. And when I spoke to Christine Crine, who heads up the judging panel for CBOB, I asked her whether having such a wide choice at this early stage of the competition can actually be a bit daunting for some.
I think people get put off a bit because there are so many choices, but you can just vote for the beers in your region, and you don't have to vote for every single beer. You've got a choice of five beers in each of the 14 categories, but you can just vote for one in each of them if you want. But it's a great way of supporting your local breweries, because from national level, through the tasting panels, it's very difficult for them to try all of the beers that are possibly could be put forward. And that's really why we need the members' help.
How do the beers that are up for voting, how do they get selected to be in that list in the first place? I had a quick search for a brewery near me, and I couldn't find anything from them on there, which really surprised me.
What it comes down to is the brewery liaison officers will list the beers on Camera Central System. It used to be called the Brewery Information System. It's now got a name called Pilgrim. And what they do is they determine whether it's cask, whether it's actually a proper real ale, if it's available a reasonable months of the year, depending on the beer style. It has to be available all year round, or if it's a seasonal for certain months. And there are certain other categories where things like barley wines, which are only available for a couple of months a year, where any of those can go through. So that's the first thing. And then that's listed onto the CBOB system, the Champion Beer Britain system, and people can vote from that. So it's very much a yes or no at that stage.
One of the things that's always influenced my voting in this, and I don't know whether it's right or wrong or whether I should even admit this to the chief judge, but I sometimes think, oh, I had a lovely pint of whatever it was when I was on holiday 2 years ago. I'd love to vote for that. It was fantastic. But because I haven't been on holiday to that particular part of the country since then, if the beer's on the list, I'm guessing it's still as good as it was when I drank it 2 years ago. But is that really what I should be doing? Or should I only be voting for beers that I've had, say, in the last 12 months?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Beers do change, of course. The brewers may not be able to get the ingredient. I mean, one time we had a lot of problems with getting hops from the United States. And in fact, actually, it's not great at the moment. So they had to alter their recipes. So often the beer you're tasting today may not have the same recipe that the beer had 2 years ago. So really, you should be voting for beers that you've had really in the last 12 or 18 months, I'd say, because there's a good chance the brewers altered the recipe. And brewers do like to experiment, which gives us a bit of a nightmare in terms of things like altering alcohol contents, because a lot of our style categories are based on alcohol content. So if they move the alcohol content, it can sometimes move from one category to another, which gives us another problem.
Let's talk about this year's winners, because there was quite a lot of publicity, particularly, in fact, sadly, really, because the overall winner did get a lot of publicity, but it was the runner-up that perhaps got more publicity, Abbott Ale, of course. And there was a lot of people saying, oh, Abbott Ale shouldn't have even been there. It shouldn't have even won. What do you say when you hear things like that?
Well, if we're going to take that approach, then we wouldn't be the Champion Beer Britain. It'd be the Champion Beer of smaller breweries. And actually, that's more what the Society of Independent Brewers Association do, although they have bigger brewers there too. What we're trying to do is to find the best beer regardless of who brews it. And let's be honest, some of the big brewers, a lot of the big brewers have very well qualified and very, very good brewers. So I think it would be unfair to stop the bigger brewers coming in. I mean, and where do you draw the line? I mean, you've got someone like Fuller's, who's now was independent, but now is owned by Asahi, of course. Would you stop them coming in? I mean, they and Timothy Taylor's have been the two biggest winners of the Champion Beer Britain in its history. And although you don't see Fuller's draft beer getting through to the finals very often these days, their bottled beer, particularly the 1845, regularly comes up to the finals. And in fact, it made the final beer judging of the bottled beer category this year. So if they produce a good beer, then it should be judged on the production, not on who brews it.
And of course, to reach the final judging, it would have been on our screens, on our phones, to vote for in this round, the members' round, in the early stages. People would have voted, or it wouldn't have been there in the first place, I guess.
Yes, I mean, but there's two ways of coming into the Champion Beer Britain. One is the members' votes, and the other one is through the tasting panels. And what they do, and I chair the London one, for example, is we taste the beers that are brewed just in London all the way through the year, and we give an overall score as to whether or not we think it's worthy of going forward to the Champion Beer Britain. And that enables us to have a look at a whole range of different beers and keep a record of how those beers have been doing over the year. And they can go up and down. And we've had beers that we're looking as if we're put forward this year that certainly wasn't in last year, and vice versa. So we try and be as objective as we can. And really, that's what we're trying to do with the Champion Britain. It's not perfect. No beer judging is. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to what the beer tastes on that day. And that's a bit of potluck sometimes.
And it goes through a number of judging panels, doesn't it? You have the category judging and then the overall judging. And that all takes place at the Great British Beer Festival.
Yeah, what happens is that to start with, there are 9 regions, and each region judges the 14 different categories. So that's 12 draft and 2 bottled. And those are the beer, they're breweries and the beers that have been put forward by the members voting and the tasting panels. There's usually about between 6 and 9 beers that are judged in each of those categories in each region. So that's a lot. And then the winners of that then get put forward either to the Winter Champion Beer Britain, where the winter overall winner is awarded, or it goes through to the summer. And then the winners of the winter one get put in with the summer ones, and then we find our overall winner. Because Ellen Porter won the Winter Hours one, and that's how that got through.
It's all blind judging at the judges don't know what the... They might have a strong idea, I guess, if they know the beer, but they technically don't know what they're drinking.
No, you don't. And we deliberately try and keep people away from, for example, the programmes, and the judges are not allowed around the where the beer is kept. We are quite secretive, and quite rightly so, because it can influence a perception. I'll give you a really good example. A few years ago, I was chairing the final of the Champion Beer Britain, and we really couldn't make up our minds between 2 beers. They were very, very good, and it was a whisper in it. And afterwards, it actually was Crouch Vale Vale, a gold, that won. And they'd actually won the previous year too. Very unusual, but they won 2 years running. The runner-up was Harvest Sussex Best Bitter. And at least one judge came up to me and said, if I'd realised this beer, the Crouch Vale, was the same beer that won last year, I would have voted for the Harvest Sussex Best. Now, that's influencing the judging because people knew what the beer was like. Whether that was a big good thing or a bad thing, you can argue, but it shows you it can influence your judging. So we don't know. So you don't know the beers.
I remember Crouch Vale winning 2 years on the trot, and Brewer's Gold is a lovely beer.
It is.
It's a well-deserved winner, in my opinion. One thing that didn't quite sit comfortably with me this year, and perhaps you're the wrong person to ask about this because obviously it was nothing to do with you from this point of view, but Abbott was a major sponsor of the festival. It was plastered everywhere. They'd obviously put a lot of money to promote that particular brand at that particular festival. Is there perhaps a way of looking at the commercial aspect? I can understand people being upset that one of the festival's big 4 sponsors also took a big prize.
It was pure chance, absolute pure chance, because it was the members in the East Anglia region that put the Abbott forward. It then had to be judged at that level, and then it goes through 2 sets of judging at the Great British Beer Festival. There is an initial round where we judge each of the beer styles, so there are 14 panels effectively going place. This one was in the premium bitters category, and it was judged against 8 other premium bitters, and the judges on that table, and they're a mix of people. We make sure we have people from different backgrounds. So there's a couple of camera trained judges, because they have to, at the national level, we like them to go through a training program and pass. There is actually a written test. And then we usually have a couple of brewers, at least one licensee, and perhaps 1 or 2 other trade people. So it's a mix of people. It's not just a camera member saying, this is the best beer. It's a real mix of people that actually came up and said, Abbott was the best on that table. If you'd done it another day, you might have ended up with a different decision. And a different panel may have made a different decision. But on that day, that was their decision.
It is quite daunting looking at all those beers to choose from. I mean, I must admit, I just sat there and my head was swimming by the end of every, I couldn't, you know, I'd had to go onto the website, make a shortlist, leave it, come back and look the next day. Do you guys find the same thing when you look at all those beers to choose from?
Yeah, there's a lot there, isn't there? Even for me, you know, and obviously I do it for a living. But I think that probably the best way to do it is to pick a couple of beers that you really want to vote for, or a couple of styles that you're very passionate about and have been drinking around, and just go for those. Goes for those sections. If you find the whole thing a bit much, just pick those out and focus on those.
Yeah, I would certainly echo those thoughts, and in particular the bit about choosing a style that you like. You know, if you go into the style and you see some of the beers that are listed, then I think it'll bring back some memories and some, you know, fond memories of that, and you'll think that beer there, that's worth my vote today. But certainly it's an incredibly comprehensive process, and you know, there are pros and cons to that, but hopefully it means that the true champion beer of Britain will never slip through the net.
And yeah, it's right, isn't it, what Christine was saying about not you know, including some of the big breweries in there as well, isn't it, Claire?
That's right. I mean, we obviously talked about the controversy over Abbott Ale and the fact that they were a sponsor of the festival, as you heard in the interview there. But as Christine said, you can't make it just a competition for breweries of a certain size, because that's not the champion beer of Britain. It's more, as Christine herself said, a small brewery competition.
Yeah, I mean, there's the wonderful SIBA competition that already runs. I've been part of judging for that in the past, and that's something that's a very well-organised and comprehensive competition, but simply focused on small breweries. So there's some really good competitions out there that do exactly that.
So hopefully Christine's gone some of the way to explain why you can't just say, oh, they're too big to be in Champion Beer of Britain. As far as she's concerned, nobody's too big to be in the competition.
Or indeed too small. Elland, who won, a fantastic brewery, but they really are rather small. So it's great to see everybody getting involved.
And the other thing, of course, we've mentioned, you know, just pick the styles you like. You could also just pick from your region. You don't have to go all around the country, particularly if you haven't tried the beers for a while. So when it comes to voting next autumn, because obviously voting has closed for next year's beer, but around about sort of October time next year, maybe just look for beers from your part of the world and pick ones that you really know and add them to the shortlist. That sounds a great way of doing it.
Fantastic. So I think it's time, folks, for last orders. So this is where we talk about the favourite beer or cider that we've been drinking this week or this month. So a slightly different format from Simon and myself this time, because we've done something different, haven't we, Simon?
We certainly have. You were determined to introduce me to a range of milds, so milds that we could get in bottle and can format. And you were kind enough to come and visit me in the city close to where I work. And we sat down, we opened four different milds, and we enjoyed a very pleasant hour or two sipping and tasting and making some notes.
So, Simon, here we go. We've got four milds in front of us. So, should we describe what we have here? So, the first one is the one that you got. So, tell us a bit about this.
So, this is Gunpowder Premium Mild from Coach House Brewery up in Warrington, Cheshire.
I've got a Reedham Mild. So, Claire will be proud of me because this is from Norfolk. And this is from the Humpty Dumpty Brewery in Reedham in Norfolk. So, this one comes in at a slightly stronger 4.5%. We're going to start with the Gunpowder Mild. This is an unknown quantity to me. What about you? Have you tried this before?
I've not tried it before, no.
Fantastic. So, let's see what we have. We've got some very nice little tasting glasses. We're only taking little tasting nips, aren't we, Simon? Because we're very professional.
We're responsible.
But this one is only 3.8%, so it's a good sort of standard mild. So, colour-wise, it's exactly what I'd expect to see. It's got a lovely creamy, sort of tan-coloured creamy head on top. How would you describe that colour, Simon?
It's not quite black. It's not quite as dark as a stout or a porter, but it's not far off, is it?
Yeah, sort of chocolatey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Chocolate brown, is that a fair colour?
Yeah, I
colour?
Think that's a fair colour.
And the nose, I don't even need to put it up to my nose because I'm already getting that lovely kind of character that I'm looking for with a mild, which is first and foremost that dark fruit aroma, sort of plum. And then we get that lovely maltier than a malty thing that won the malty competition malt loaf smell. Does that
malt
fit?
Loaf is exactly what you can smell.
Mm. And yes, it's got that lovely creamy smoothness. Again, it's really gentle across the palate. It's got a little bit of carbonation.
Yep.
Very pleasant. And
just so soft and easy to drink, and really all about the malt, which is what we like.
As you said, all about the malt, but very creamy. That's the word that stood out. As soon as you said it, that's what I recognised from tasting that on my palate. And I, as someone who doesn't drink milds on a regular basis, I wouldn't necessarily have expected it to be as creamy as it is.
So we've got the Reedham Mild in our glass. It's definitely a lighter shade, I think. It's got a little sort of different colour going on.
It's a much lighter shade of brown. Almost matches the bottle that it's come in.
Yeah, that sort of brown bottle colour. On the nose, nowhere near as aromatic as the first, as the gunpowder. It's got a sort of much more of a stouty smell, actually. I'm getting a sort of crackery kind of malt aroma going on. Oh, yeah, OK. It's got a bit more of a bitter character. It's also got a bit more of that stouty backbone.
For me, verging slightly on this slightly sour taste to it, for me.
It's not as sweet as that gunpowder mild that we tried, and I think we're seeing the contrast. Although I do enjoy that kind of slightly tangy, kind of crackery quality, and it's still definitely soft on the palate, although it has got a little bit more oomph. It's got a bit more of a stouty kind of spine, I would say, to it. Maybe a slightly different recipe coming through there. And giving us that different character. So now we have a certified champion in front of us, Simon. The Champion Beer of Britain 2011. And I'm waving a flag for Essex here because my pub is on the border of Essex. Yep. We're in London, but on the borders of Essex. And this is from the wonderful Mighty Oak Brewery in Maldon, brewing there since 1996. And this is a thoroughly proper 3.7 ABV for a dark mild. And it is, of course, the Oscar Wilde mild. So to look at, it's got a slightly pinkish hue, I think. So it is our chocolate brown with a slightly pinkish hue and a nice little cheeky caramel coloured head. What are you getting on the nose, Simon? Delicious.
I'll let you describe the nose.
I get caramel. I really do. Caramel. I get caramel. You know that Dulce de Leche spread on malt loaf? That's what I'm getting. Dulce de Leche on malt loaf.
But with the others, it's the malt that shines through, isn't it? The malt is a backbone to a good mild.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Again, very creamy for me.
Lovely, smooth, creamy body. So we've got Maris Otter malt in here, that venerable brewing malt, malted barley. We've got pale crystal malt and we've got some black malts. We also know there's a little bit of wheat probably helping a bit with the head, and it's hopped with the classic British Challenger. So we've got that sort of gentle hopping. It's, you know, as we know with this style, it's not really about the hops, is it? It's just the hops there to sort of play their background role. And my goodness, this is tasty, isn't it? I mean,
it is very tasty. very tasty.
I have to say, I could drink quite a lot of this, which at 3.7 is probably not the worst, is it? Now, excellent job, Mighty Oak Brewery, the Oscar Wilde. Last but not least of our little tasting lineup, we have the amazing Boxcar. And this is not the regular mild, this is the double dark mild. Have you looked at the alcohol by volume on this one?
I believe it's 6.5%.
Let's have a double check. Yeah, 6.3, not quite 6.5. So this one hereby hangs a tale. This is the wonderful Sam Dickison, the brewer who fell in love with mild when he visited a beer festival with a friend and discovered just how incredibly drinkable and soft and delicious mild was. And among all the other craft brewing that he does, all the wonderful hoppy IPAs and pale ales, he decided he wanted to start brewing a mild. And his dark mild comes in at 3.6, was a massive hit. And this was kind of an extension of that sort of, I think he described it as an amped up version, is that right?
That's exactly what it says on the back of the can. So interesting to see a mild sold in a can. And again, for a brewery based in London, London's history of porters and stouts and dark beers, you know, it's a modern twist.
It certainly is. Unfortunately, he was based, 2016 he started brewing, he was based in Bethnal Green E2, but in February 23, landlord issues meant that he closed the site. So he's now Cuckoo Brewing, but I'm very much hoping that he's able to continue brewing this little beauty. Here it is. Dark chocolate colour, again with that lovely sort of tan caramel coloured head, and already we can smell the incredible intensity of the aroma.
You can smell the alcohol on this just before you even put it to your lips.
I get this incredible caramel, sort of butterscotchy, malty, again that malt loaf with butter kind of aroma going on here. Big, rich, soft.
Very warming.
but that dark plummy fruit really comes through. I know there's a lot of people who are big fans of the Titanic plum porter. Have you tried that one?
Oh yes, yes.
Well, this has almost got that. I know there's no plums
it's
in
like
it.
It's like that,
yeah.
But a little bit more subtle, I think.
Mm. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
A very suitable beer as we come into the Christmas season.
It's really complex, that one, isn't it? Very, very Moorish and really delicious. That's probably the sipper of all of these malts that we've tried, and I guess that's no surprise given what it is, but wow, that is a clever beer.
Again, looking forward to Christmas, and some people will drink a nice strong beer with their Christmas cake or some cheese. You can imagine this going quite well with either of those.
Absolutely, I can tell you this is fantastic with a nice sharp cheddar. Really good, and as you say, it works well and stands up to sweeter desserts, particularly on that sort of dried fruity style, because it's got that character, hasn't it? But yeah, it's quite a thing, and I really hope, Sam, you keep brewing this beauty, because it's one of our absolute favorites. There is a triple dark mild as well that is pretty strong. I can't remember the ABV of it, but it's pretty big. But this for me is absolutely gorgeous. We've had the dark mild on cask a couple of times, and it's wonderful. Wow. Too.
I'm going to stick to the Christmas theme for a second and say, so, you know, some people, when they make their Christmas cake at home and they feed their cake with alcohol over the couple of months leading up to Christmas, it'd be interesting to feed a Christmas cake with this.
Oh, yeah, feed your cake and then drink the rest of it.
And drink the rest of it.
Well, it sounds like you two had a great time trying all those milds. Alison, if you're ever on your travels up to Suffolk, do bring a case of milds with you this direction as well. Simon, what was your favourite of those milds?
Well, I have to say, Alison's done a great job in opening my eyes to mild and what it's all about. So it was a close-run thing in terms of favourites, but the Oscar Wilde Mild from Mighty Oak in Essex. Came a close second. That'll be a drink that's known to quite a few of our listeners. But the winner that just shaded it was from Boxcar, and it was their Double Dark Mild, which was sublime.
Oh, I've not tried that one. I mean, Oscar Wilde Mild has been a former Seabob winner, I think, Supreme Champion, as I recall, some years ago.
Yes.
I'll have to look out for that one. Well, I'm going in completely the other direction. I'm going to pick a pale ale. This is one that's brewed relatively locally to me, actually, and it's from a craft brewery called Jack Rabbit. Now, they're fairly small. They only started in 2019, and they started, a couple of friends set up the brewery in an old piggery, I believe, because they loved pale ale, and they've been brewing cask pale ale and a number of other pales since then. And I had their current pale ale at a local pub on Friday night, and the fact how they've grown and they've come through COVID and done a really good job. You do find their beers in some of the beer festivals now, and they've got a wide selection. You can get it in cans, and really nice to see. I had their New England pale ale, and it's really nice to see a small brewery growing, expanding, doing well. They're called Jack Rabbit. They were originally based in Manningtree. I think they've moved into slightly bigger premises now, but I had a lovely pint of their beer, and I shall look forward to trying more of it. So, yeah, so that's my choice. I'm afraid, you know, no milds, letting the side down, picking a pale ale, but we're here for all tastes, and that's just about it from us. We'll see you in our next episode, but for now, cheers!
Cheers! Cheers!
How does a free case of beer sound?
Yes, you can grab a case for free, courtesy of our pals at Beer 52, by going to www.beer52.com/people, that's the numbers 52 in the 52, and covering the meagre postage cost of £5.95. And what's more, as a special offer for our listeners, they'll throw in 2 extra beers for free, so that's 10 unique craft beers.
Beer 52 is actually the biggest beer club in the world. Each month, they send their members a case of beer from a different part of the world, and this month it's an absolute belter. Their Great European Road Trip case takes in the best beers from across the continent.
So try a crisp, refreshing Pilsner from Norway's Lervig Brewery and a monster 7.5 double IPA from Sweden's Durges Brewery. On the dark side this month, there's a smooth stout from Copenhagen's Tuol. There's also beer from Croatia, Poland, Germany, Serbia and Austria, among others.
And if dark beer's not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. Also included is the ever-insightful Ferment magazine and a couple of tasty snacks. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel at any time.
So head over to www.beer52.com/people to claim your free case of 10 beers now.